With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This week on the Gary Hour.
Sometimes people say to me, oh, you can't skip the line. You know, you gotta, you know, it's just like people saying about politics. Oh, you gotta first be a congressman, then a senator, then a vice president, then a governor, then a vice president, then a president. No, if you're good at understanding how to skip the line, like Barack Obama was,
yeah.
That skill set of skipping the line applies to many areas, but you can if you know how to do it.
I'm asking this selfishly because I'm expecting a kid at the end of August.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. My first.
Your life is just going to suck. There is nothing good about having a baby.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, like tell me something good. Nobody's successful when they're first starting because by definition, they suck when they first start. You need experience to be better at something. So you have to have some kind of weird confidence that makes you think you can be better when there's no evidence whatsoever that you can be.
Right.
And so there's a certain persistence, a certain what Nassim Taleb would call anti-fragility. Like what
How about for
you?
A bit of delusion?
Yeah, there's got to be. There's certainly got to be delusion.
Welcome to another episode of The Gary Hour. I am your host, Gary Levitt. This week, I talk to James Altucher. If you don't know who James is, he is a best-selling author of a couple books. He has an extremely popular podcast himself called The James Altucher Show, where he's interviewed Richard Branson, Sonia Sotomayor. He's had pretty much everyone on his podcast. It's really popular. And I listen to it, and it's really good. So check that out. He's also an entrepreneur a couple times over, which you'll hear about in this podcast. But he made millions, then he lost it, and then he made millions again. Not an easy task. This episode is brought to you by Future Moments, makers of mobile apps for content creation. If you're a musician, a podcaster, a voiceover artist, go to any app store and search for Future Moments because there's an app there that'll make your life easier and your productions so much better. I really enjoyed this conversation with James. I hope you do too, and I think you'll get something out of it for sure. Check out the show notes for links and go to GaryGaryLevitt.com for more info. Thanks for listening. I know we have so much to talk about, so I had to make an outline. Okay.
Okay, yeah, no problem. And Gary, by the way, thanks so much for having me on the show. I am really grateful. Happy to be here.
Thank you for doing it. All right, first of all, you have personally reinvented yourself so many times. In the early 90s, you started as an IT in the IT department of HBO. Then you somehow ended up hosting a show.
Well, here's what happened. I went to undergrad and grad school for computer science.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be an academic. I was thrown out of grad school. And then I wanted to be a writer. I wrote like 4 or 5 unpublishable novels in my early 20s.
Why'd they throw you out of grad school?
Because I suddenly mid grad school decided I wanted to be a novelist and not an academic. I didn't admire. You have to admire the lives of the people in the profession you want to be in.
Yep.
So if I wanted to be a professor, I had to ask myself, well, I'm around a lot of professors. I'm in grad school. Do any of these people have a life that I would see myself leading? And the answer was no. I didn't admire the lives of any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I admired kind of the creativity and the freedom of novelists. And I loved, of course, reading and storytelling. And so I became obsessed. I always become obsessed. I became every day I wrote from waking up to going to sleep. And of course, that means I failed every single course I was in grad school, and they threw me out.
But were you worried about the financials of it? Like, how am I going to make a living? Because doing IT department, you're pretty much guaranteed to make some.
Then I wasn't in an IT department yet. I was a programmer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had the skills. I was undergrad computer science.
Practical skills.
Yeah, I had skills for computer science, and I wasn't making any money as a writer. Any kind of creative endeavor requires years of work before you start making any money,
and risk.
Then making a living, then making wealth.
Yep.
But with software, it's a little easier. You can make a living automatically once you know how to program. So, and there's a lot of people who don't know programming but make a living programming. And I mean, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. You can get a job as a programmer with a little knowledge.
Yeah.
But I was already a good programmer. Like, I studied it. I programmed for thousands of hours since I was a kid. So I was a technologist at heart. But then I became obsessed with something else. And so, whereas previously I'd been obsessed with programming.
Right.
And I started writing every day. But to make ends meet, I would take like a job as a software programmer. And again, for me, it was easy. So I'd have to work like 15 minutes a week. Nobody knew, you know, how much I was really working. And it's good thing about being a computer programmer at most jobs, not in Silicon Valley or, let's say, a bank in New York City, but most other jobs as a programmer, no one knows. You're not doing rocket science. So it was easy for me. And then I would spend the rest of the time writing. And then I figured, you know what? I'm not publishing anything. I didn't think, well, I'm still in my 10,000 hours of learning as a writer. I didn't assume I was just sucking as a writer.
How old were you at the time?
26.
Okay.
From 21 to 26, I was writing every day and learning. I was reading and writing every day. So I'd write 3,000 words minimum a day, and I would read minimum for 2 or 3 hours a day.
What were you writing about? I mean, you have a bestseller, Choose Yourself, which is like How to Be Successful.
Right.
Basically. But when you're 21 to 26.
I was writing novels, right?
Okay.
I had no life experience. So what was I writing about? They were shitty novels.
Okay. That was fiction.
Yeah, I would read a novel that I liked, and then I would think, oh, I have an idea, and I'd be inspired. Whatever I read last would inspire whatever I was writing that day, and so my novels would take twists and turns that were sort of unbelievable.
Moby Duke.
Yeah, it's just crazy stuff, and I wrote probably dozens and dozens of short stories, and I could tell by the end of this period, there was a difference. Oh, I would look at a short story I wrote, not a novel, but a short story I wrote, and I would say, there's something different happening. Like, I could tell a muscle was being
developing.
And so I figured, but you know what, though? I was in Pittsburgh because that's where I went to grad school, and I figured I need to move to New York because that's where the literary industry is. So I had two offers for jobs, J.P. Morgan and HBO. J.P. Morgan, to be a programmer, to be in the IT department.
Yeah.
J.P. Morgan offered $80,000 a year, which I thought was like, oh my God, I'm going to be super rich if I take that. HBO offered $40,000 a year, which I also thought, oh my God, I'm going to be super rich because I had never, that was like practically double the salary I was making as a programmer in Pittsburgh. And I turned down the J.P. Morgan one, even though it was twice the money, because
Sounds incredibly boring and the other one sounds a little bit more adventurous.
You know, the programming for each was probably equally boring, but I loved HBO.
It's a different environment.
I love the TV. I didn't know anything about the brand of JP Morgan, but HBO represented something to me. It was quality story. It was the best storytelling on TV, and it would get me a little closer to what I wanted, which was to be a success in writing. And, you know, money, you know, the reason somebody offers you more money is because they're not paying you for the work you can do. Else, why was one place offering me 40 and the other place offering me double that? You know, it was for the same quality of work.
Right.
They're paying you so that you forget your dreams and do their dreams instead. So that's part of the salary of right. any salary.
So they're buying your soul. Is that
yeah, what? Exactly. And sometimes I've sold my soul and I often regretted it, but this time I didn't. I figured, look, I'm going to be just as fine on 40 as 80. Previously I'd made 20.
Right.
I didn't realize then that New York City was so much more expensive, but you really can't live. Even then you couldn't live in Manhattan on 40. But I did want to work in the entertainment industry, and I figured it would be a foot in the door for my writing. So I took that job. And
how do you finagle from the IT department to hosting your own show on HBO?
So HBO didn't have a website. Mm-hmm. So nobody had a website then, by the way. It was 1994.
Okay.
Yeah. And I pitched HBO to do a website. And I said, look, just like you have original programming, original TV shows that you made, you're not just buying movies. And mm-hmm. HBO, people don't really remember, HBO was the first channel to make their own original shows, the first cable channel to make their own original shows. I said, do original web shows. And they're like, hey, we don't know anything about this web stuff. You're young. You do it. And so I started doing an original web show, which they paid for me to shoot. So then the HBO documentaries liked what I was doing. It was a show about what crazy things happen at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night in New York City.
So you're just wandering around with a microphone and a video camera?
Yeah. And just like I turned over every rock in the city for like 3 years.
And this was in the 90s. There were still actually maybe some prostitutes and drug dealers on the streets.
Yeah, everything was. I mean, the 70s, I grew up around here and in and around New York City. So the 70s was obviously the worst in New York City.
Or best.
It was scary. Yeah, or the best. But, you know, I'm not nostalgic for it. Like, yeah. Having grown up around here, it was bad. Like, I was scared whenever I was by myself as a kid in New York.
Right.
And even in the 80s, up to like 88, 89, I was scared walking around New York. But the 90s... sometimes I was scared depending on the area, and obviously now there's no area to be scared in.
Yeah.
But the 90s, there were still interesting things happened in that sense. So I can go to the meatpacking district, and there was transvestite prostitutes, drug dealers, mm-hmm. and of course their customers. I can go to the East Village, and there was homeless. There was, you know, young kids doing crazy things.
Quality entertainment everywhere. Yes,
exactly. And I built up a real skill that I must have interviewed. So then I would, on the web, at least it was a web show at the beginning. And I would interview maybe 20 people a week. I would pick the best four, and I would have a designer design and get a transcript, you know, cause you couldn't really download video then. Very rarely would I have video, and, you know, bandwidth, what speeds weren't.
Yeah. People still kind of on dial up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I would put the best interviews up, and of course they were always scandalous and interesting, and I would write kind of intros and some commentary. So finally I was like a writer for HBO, mm-hmm. and so that was like a credit. You know, I should use that credit in comedy.
Totally. So, wrote for HBO.
Yeah, you might have seen him on HBO and blah blah blah.
You were streaming video before Netflix.
Yeah, it was kind of the first podcast, mm-hmm. in a weird way. Like, right. I was interviewing, you know, prostitutes, drug dealers, their customers, homeless, all sorts of. I went out to Rikers Island.
Audio only.
I had some video. Occasionally, okay. I do video, but there was some audio, and then it was really though transcripts. And I would design. I had professional designers, mm-hmm. Different designers each week design the interviews. The pages for the interviews, and it was a beautiful site. It got mentioned in Time magazine as one of the best sites on the internet. And
did you feel a bit like maybe this was just research for your writing, like you were kind of a Burroughs character?
A little bit, but I love the concept too. Like, I wasn't a night person, and I realized, oh my, I was missing something. New York City has these incredible stories at night,
yep.
And there was almost like a religion of for the people who are always out at 3 a.m. on a, like, if you were, there's no reason to be out at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday night for most people. Most people have to go to work the next day or go to school the next day. So if you were out on a, not a Saturday night, but a Tuesday night at 3 a.m, there was a reason, and it probably wasn't a good reason. And so I would, so the kind of people who regularly were out at that time, it was like they were night people. It was a different way of thinking. They weren't day people.
Yeah.
And so I was fascinated by the concept. And so then I wanted to make a TV show. And
how many people in the crew?
It was me, a video person, a photographer, and a PA, like a an assistant, like a production assistant.
Yeah.
And that was it. And for a while we had a bodyguard, but then one time we were in this like transvestite club on 11th Avenue and 42nd Street, and we were kind of undercover interviewing people. Mm-hmm. And like, why are you here? You have a wife and four kids in New Jersey, and we're finding you here at 3 a.m. And a bodyguard was like, hey, you know, and then we ran, you know, a security guard at the place kicked us out. But then the bodyguard we had hired to accompany us, he was running faster than anyone. He was like 3 blocks ahead of us. So I never used a bodyguard again after that. But I did that for 3 years. So let's say 150 weeks interviewing 20 people a week. I never once missed a week. So that was 3,000 interviews. And I remember the first time I did it, I was scared to death, because you have to just go up to somebody, a complete stranger, in the middle of the night in New York City, which is a little scary, and then say, hey, can I talk to you? Like, what are you doing? And like, sometimes it was couples arguing. Sometimes it was people doing illegal activities. So sometimes, you know, occasionally the violence was threatened or things were thrown at me, or I'd have to, many times I had to run away from the situation. Not like run metaphorically, but really run. Yeah. And my crew would always stay back until I was comfortable with the
Did this ever kind of tempt you into the darker side of the world? Like, you wanted to participate?
No, because you saw, because everyone is honest. There's a certain honesty at that time. Mm-hmm. Like in a weird way, there's all this weird, even illegal activity happening, but there's a certain honesty. And this is actually an interesting topic to write about. Like, during the day, most people are filled with shit. Like, you go there's a million people working in Midtown Manhattan. They're all filled with shit. Like, they're all just kissing ass to get promotions and higher salaries and get sales. But at night, there's no reason, even like a drug dealer or a prostitute, there's no reason for them to lie to me. Like, I wasn't a customer.
Right.
They were just telling me what the way it was at, where, you know, what was going on.
Their masks are off.
Yeah. And you saw the reality, which is, A, you know, almost 100% of the time they came from really deeply troubled childhoods, like deeply troubled beyond what anything we could imagine, even if it was told to us. And B, they hated everybody. They hated their customers. Not like a prostitute was like, oh, I can't wait to meet the man of my dreams, you know, on this street corner. And, you know, and then I would go out to Rikers Island. There was a bus that would go out there at 3 a.m. and nobody was happy on that bus. You just see like kind of this other side of things. But again, there was this honesty about it, which I appreciated and which I learned a lot. But I really learned a lot about interviewing then. And also, I had to learn how to be likable within the first 2 to 3 seconds of talking.
Which is great for stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as you know, that's a critical skill. As many professional comedians have told me on my podcast, likability is an even more important skill than humor.
Right.
So, like, I'll take an extreme example. Dave Chappelle is, of course, a very humorous, funny guy. He's also extremely, extremely likable. Like, you just like him.
Yep.
And he just goes up there and he's laughing. You just want to laugh with him. Mm-hmm. And so he'll tell jokes that I could see nobody is getting, or it's just an interesting observation. There's no punchline.
Right.
But he'll start laughing and he'll hit his knee with the microphone. He'll back up like he just told the best joke in the world. And the whole audience is laughing with him, even though it's like, okay, that's an interesting observation. It's not the funniest knock knock joke I've heard ever, but you know, likability is more. And if nobody likes you, nobody will laugh.
Right.
Period.
And an audience decides this in split seconds when you first walk on stage.
Yeah, the audience is an X-ray machine. So the audience can see immediately, are you a beginner? Or are you a professional? Mm-hmm. The audience can see immediately, are you confident? Are you just trying stuff? And adults do not want to see other adults try things.
Right.
Adults are paying to go to a comedy club because they want to see comedy. They don't want to see you trying to they don't want to see you checking off your bucket list.
Have you heard this theory that people with narrow faces like mine are less likable than people with fat faces?
I have not heard that. But that's interesting.
Yeah, there's that thing in our culture of, I don't know if it's nature or nurture, but the fat jolly guy, we like him, Santa Claus. You know, well, then the evil guy always has like a narrow face.
But I wonder how they did that study, because I do think guys who are heavy are funnier than guys who are skinny in general. Not in every case. Like, right. Dave Chappelle obviously is skinny, and now he's committed the horrible sin of getting like jacked. He's got muscles. Uh-huh. And I say that it's a sin because people really don't like laughing at the muscular guy.
Yeah.
But Dave Chappelle has transcended a lot of these cliches. But I think fat guys, I shouldn't say fat, like heavy guys, they develop a humor skill early on because that's their defense mechanism as a kid. So I wonder how any study that says that, I wonder how they control for that factor.
Right.
So like there's a base level of humor that probably heavier guys, or like, let's say a midget, or let's say, I don't know if that's the correct word or not, but you know, other types of problems, those people have developed a humor, in some cases, those people have developed a baseline humor higher than the average person as a defense mechanism.
I think if you show all kinds of people a picture of a guy with a fat face and a guy with a narrow face, they'll say, I like that guy more. The guy with the fat face, I like him more.
Here's another one. If you speak an octave higher, that's usually people think that's funnier than if you speak like think about Dave Chappelle and his recent specials. Yeah. I'm always using him as an example because he's considered the best comedian in the world now. Uh-huh. Him or Louis C.K. or whatever your preferences are. But Dave Chappelle in a recent special, he sat down and he just spoke seriously to the audience in the middle of his stand-up because he was talking about what's going on in the country and he got serious. He went literally an octave lower when he was talking seriously and nobody was laughing. And then when he went back to comedy, it's an octave higher.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so I only noticed that after someone told me the octave thing.
Yeah.
And I think when I'm doing public speaking or when I'm doing stand-up, I'm almost, because I'm speaking a little bit louder, my voice gets a little higher, so I have that octave thing going for me.
Yeah.
I think.
You've actively done that in stand-up.
I've accidentally done it, and then someone told me about that.
Right. So. Okay, so you have so many different identities, we'll call them. You reinvented yourself.
Yeah, I can just quickly list through them.
And okay, then please.
So, first off, I was a top young chess player as a kid. I was New Jersey's junior chess champion. I was a master. I was one of the best kids in the country for my age group.
Uh-huh.
In terms of obsessions, I'm going to skip other things, but these are things where I would spend everything I list now. I spent at least 8 to 12 hours a day on. So chess, then computers, then writing, then kind of this 3 a.m. entertainment type stuff, then entrepreneurship. I started a business creating websites for other companies. Our first client was AmericanExpress.com. And then we did every movie studio. We did every record label. We did all the gangster rap labels, actually. Mm-hmm. We did all their websites.
And this was your company?
Yeah, my company.
Okay. I want to get back to a lot of this, but I
started while I was at HBO. So I was an employee at HBO, and I started a company a few blocks away because so many people saw what I was doing for HBO. All the other entertainment companies said, we want this.
Right.
And so I could have just giving them advice and kept rising up at HBO, and I was doing well in the corporate hierarchy at HBO when I was succeeding there. But I started a company, hired people, twins. I stayed at my job for 18 months. And finally, when I had about close to, you know, over a dozen employees and we were getting to be over $1 million in revenues with my company on the side, I finally left HBO to full-time run my own company.
Mm-hmm.
And
Did you end up selling that?
Yeah, I ended up selling that.
Is that, when you sold it, did that give you enough money to kind of be well?
That gave me so much money. My children and my grandchildren could have lived forever without worrying about money. And then within 3 years of selling it, I lost every single dime. Like I never really went into debt, or that's not totally true, but I had $143 left in my ATM, as opposed to a year earlier from that point, having $15 million in my ATM.
Okay. How old were you at the time? You sold your company. You
got I sold my company when I was 30.
Okay, so you're a multimillionaire.
Yeah, 30. Tens of millions. And then 3 years later, 3 to 4 years later, dead broke. I had to. What? I had nothing.
What did you do with all this money?
Well, I wish I could say I did fun things like, you know, hookers and cocaine and all that, and all that stuff. But, and I tell people actually, you know, I really hated running my company. So after I sold it, I was really happy.
Yeah.
And I still had to work, but I just stopped going to work. I had a deal where I had to stay at the company for a year.
Right.
But I stopped doing that. And all I did, I got obsessed. All I did was play poker. So there was various underground clubs in New York City.
Yes.
Like the Mayfair Club and the Diamond Club. The Mayfair Club, you might know, is like featured in the movie Rounders.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the summer, I got a house in Atlantic City. I would take a helicopter to Atlantic City. So people think, oh, I get it. You were a gambler. No, I was like a great poker player. Because I was a great chess player, it was easy for me to transfer that skill to poker.
Doing the math.
Yeah, and lots of things. Just being, you know, part of getting good at a game is having kind of a killer. It's like you want to kill the person on the other side. Yeah. So you get like...
Also good for stand-up comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to kill the audience.
And also you learn how to study games. You learn how to quickly find the shortcuts. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, the hard way to get good at Scrabble is to have a great vocabulary. The easy way to get great at Scrabble mm-hmm. is to learn all the two-letter words, all the Q without U words,
right.
all the J words.
The strategies to get more points.
You know, in Scrabble, there's something called stems. So, no, again, this has nothing to do with vocabulary. There are six-letter combinations, like S-A-T-I-N-E, mm-hmm. where if you give me any letter or almost any letter, I could find a seven-letter word for it. Like you memorize these seven-letter word lists from these things called stems, which are these six-letter combinations. So I know for any game you give me, I know how to find the shortcuts to become a master at that game. So mm-hmm. poker, there are shortcuts as well. And at that time, this is pre-TV poker. At that time, I quickly became very good. So I'd go around Atlantic City and I didn't need the money at that time, of course, but it was the equivalent of making a living. I could make money anytime
you
I wanted to.
You hacked all these games.
Yeah. So like in terms of games, you know, chess, Go, I don't know if you know what that is, but it's the most popular game in the world because it's the most popular game in China. Chess, Go, poker, backgammon, Scrabble, Monopoly, Othello, checkers, all these kind of classic games.
Yeah.
I'm like the similar level at,
uh-huh.
Cause there's all the similar types of shortcuts, card games like hearts.
One skill from one carries over to the other.
The skill of learning
right.
carries over.
Mm-hmm.
So in not some other skills, like in chess, you have to calculate several moves ahead. You have to have that skill.
Yep.
That doesn't really apply in poker so much. It applies a tiny bit. Like if I make this bet, he might think I have this hand, so he might make this bet, and then I'll do this. So you might think a few moves ahead in poker, but yeah. it's not like thinking 18 moves ahead.
Do you still play?
I played. I don't play seriously.
Uh-huh.
That's the one problem of doing this is that once I stop, like to really get back to a professional level, it would take me a good 6 to 12 months of solid
immersion.
Study and play.
Yeah.
But when I sit down and play with professionals and just one, you know, I have a friend. She comes over, we might play one-on-one, and she's a professional and is winning money regularly. And some days I win, some days she wins, and we'll mm-hmm. play all afternoon. But that's just, on any one day, I'm good enough where anything could happen. But if I were to consistently play her, I'm sure the professional would win. It would take me 6 to 12 months of study now to really be at that level again.
So you didn't lose your money gambling?
No, I
Where'd
was making a living.
Helicopter rides to Atlantic City, all of them?
No, I mean, because when you have tens of millions, like a $900 helicopter or an $1,800 helicopter ride to Atlantic City, doesn't really...
Yeah. If your money's invested...
Well, and by the way, the helicopter ride would be $1,800. As soon as I sat down I would go immediately go to the... I'd go on a Friday night and I would go straight to the Taj Mahal, sit down at the poker table. The first hand, I'm either going to win or lose more than $1,800. So
right.
the helicopter ride was nothing. And I'm not even trying to brag, simply because at the end of this whole period, I had $143 left in the bank. But what happened is that when you make money like that, everybody suddenly was telling me, oh my gosh, you must be a genius. And you made this money doing the internet and technology. I was like the stereotype cliche of a genius, and I had the glasses and the wild hair, Jewish, made money in technology.
You know you still do, right?
Yeah, I still do. I use this actually, I was an MC last night,
yeah.
And so I didn't really need to make new material. I was just riffing with the crowd, and I said, I'm racially profiled. Like, if you look like me, everybody in the world thinks you're a genius. Like, right, I could walk into any meeting, particularly a business meeting, I could walk into any business meeting and say the stupidest, most bullshit things, and everyone will think that
was
genius.
As long as you say it confidently.
Oh, yeah, which is no problem.
Yeah. Also good for stand-up comedy.
Yeah, that's a stand-up comedy skill, definitely.
Confidence.
And it works. Like, I've... Looking how I do, and also being a chess master, has helped me so much, even though neither thing has anything to do with intelligence. But people assume, oh, chess, you must be a genius. Chess alone got me into college, got me into graduate school, got me my job at HBO, raised money for a hedge fund, raised money for other businesses. It's gotten me so much. Just people, you're a chess master? Oh, yeah, here's a check. Here's a job. Of course you get into graduate
school. You're exercising critical thinking, playing chess.
Yeah, but believe me, chess is not correlated to intelligence at all. Mm-hmm. Like, go down and watch. If you don't believe me, go to Union Square any day of the week, and you'll lose every game of chess, and the guys you're losing to, right. You know, it's like the hustlers.
Yeah.
They are not what you would call intelligent people.
Right. Well, what is intelligence? You know, how do you measure that?
I think intelligence is an ability... Well, there's two types of intelligence. One is if you know a lot, right? So if you read a lot and you talk to a lot of people and you're open-minded and curious, you're going to know a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing a lot of things helps the other side of intelligence, which is an ability to be creative and problem-solve very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's many types of intelligence, I guess, and there's we're not even talking emotional intelligence, right, and stuff like that. But I'm just talking just in terms of sheer what I would consider, you know, someone who's smart. Is someone who both knows a lot, but then is able to take those skills and apply it to critical thinking and solve problems,
right,
and then execute on them. You know, people think executing is different than coming up with ideas, but they're sort of the same thing. You can't execute unless you have ideas about how to execute. And some people have bad execution ideas and some people have good execution ideas. And there's a big difference there.
Then there's people that can creatively think of solutions to problems,
yeah,
without having to look it up and find it.
Right. And now that is related to game playing a little bit, like in... Just take chess or poker as an example. The more creative player tends to win more games. But, you know, there are other skills in game playing that are probably more important.
So you just lavishly spent all your money?
No, I didn't even do that. I did buy a big apartment where I spent millions of dollars. But here's what I did that was really bad, is that I thought I was smart. And so I thought that, and I had what I call the disease. I thought I didn't have enough money. I thought like, oh, I only made this. And fucking this guy made a billion. I'm not going to, I didn't make enough. I'm poor. Right. I honestly thought in my mind, I had a disease. It's like a mental illness. I honestly thought I was dirt poor. And so in order to make more money, you have to take big risks.
Mm.
And this is the main thing I've learned about investing and entrepreneurship. This is 20 years ago. But since then, these are the main things I've learned. Investing in entrepreneurship is not about taking risks. Many people think it is. It's actually not. It's far less risky than working at a corporate job, for instance. A corporate job is much more risky, and that there's nuances in that, which we can either go into or not. But the key with entrepreneurship and investing, which I learned the hard way by losing tens of millions of dollars, is to eliminate as much risk as you can.
Also good for stand-up comedy.
Yes. Although that one, I need to understand the nuances a little bit more. But yeah, you need to stack the odds.
You eliminate the risk of bombing.
Yeah. So there's a couple. So let's riff on that for a second. Like, you eliminate the risk of bombing, for instance, by having likability, like being self-deprecating.
Developing
right away.
Your likability. Yeah.
Right. Having some skills in crowd work. So the crowd, they either feel a connection with you or they're afraid of you. So sometimes with crowd work, they don't want to be called on.
Right.
But if they sense that you're doing, that you can slip into crowd work, they're not going to, they want you to do material and they're going to laugh at your material. And a laugh, even if it's a fake laugh, will trigger other people to have real laughs. Like, laughter is viral the way yawning's viral.
Yeah.
So that removes risk. Another way to remove risk is to, of course, prepare. So so I write every day for stand-up and practice on stage. Another way to reduce risk is to watch a lot of comedy. So sometimes when I'm on stage, right before I go on, I'll picture myself as I'll feel like the personality of the comedian I was just watching. So I'll always watch like great comedy right before I go up. Mm-hmm. So I can, at the very least, if I feel something risky is happening, I could slip into that persona at least slightly.
Oh, that's your safety net. Yeah.
Yeah. And then another way is, of course, if you know somebody in the audience, they're laughing. So that will triggers, that signals to the rest of the audience that you're likable if at least one person likes you.
My safety net is I have an anchor in the audience. So if there's someone that I could tell likes me, that's the person I always go back to. That's my anchor. It's like touching a wall or something.
Yeah, I have realized that. I guess I haven't taken advantage of that as much as I should, because sometimes I feel like if I just focus on this one table, maybe the other tables are not paying attention to me.
Right.
But I do that because sometimes it's just fun to have fun with that one table that really likes you a lot.
Seinfeld talks about this. He says that's getting good at stand-up comedy. It's not about taking risks. It's about eliminating the risk of bombing.
Right. So his thing is, if you know through experience that you have really good material, just stick with your material and eventually the audience will come back. Mm-hmm. That works in an hour long set. It does not, in an hour long set where everybody already knows you, that works. In a 15-minute set, that won't work. Particularly if in New York City, the style is a typical show is 7 or 8 comedians doing between 5 and 15 minutes each. Mm-hmm. And if they don't like you, they tune out because the next comedian's a few minutes away. So you can't always win them back.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of shows with Mark Normand and I've seen him, you know, he tests material out like all stand-up comedians do. You got to test some new stuff. And then I've seen him lose an audience and I'll be like, oh, I'm bombing. All right. And then he'll pull out a joke that he did on Conan that he knows works. And then I'll win the audience back.
Yeah.
And then he'll try new material again.
So I think that does work. Like I think every comedian does that. Like if you have a joke that you know works, even if you've retired it, I will bring it back because I know it will get the laugh.
That's eliminating the risk.
And you know, the thing is, you know, if something, sometimes I don't even know why something gets a laugh, but if you know something gets a laugh each time, you can always pull it out and use it.
And you have to deliver it the same way.
Right. Yeah. You can't deliver it like, oh, I'm going to repeat what I did on Conan. You have to do it now in a good way. Like you have to, you can't think I'm just going to redo what I did. You have to still be in the now. But if you do the joke, if you deliver the joke well.
But if you take the risk of changing the cadence or the delivery, then you're not eliminating risk because maybe that joke won't work.
Right. I know. I agree with that. And then interesting. I mean, we could probably talk about specific comedians.
I know. That's why I made an outline because I know this hour is going to fly by.
Because we could talk more about like Mark Norman style versus other stuff. But okay. So
we've only gotten to my first outline.
So the way I lost all the money was I thought I was smart and I started making huge, huge investments. I was a big believer in the internet of all things.
Smart.
And so I would make a huge, huge investments on internet companies. But this was before the first internet bust. So even though I was ultimately correct on the trend, and I have one particular overriding skill, which is, I almost sounded like a bragging because the skill is meaningless if you do it like how I just
get
it
out now. This way you could be self-deprecating on stage.
So, well, I knew everybody was telling me, no, the internet's a scam because the internet bust happened, but I just kept throwing more and more money. I'm like, no, the internet is just going to keep growing. And I threw literally $15 million into internet companies,
different dot-com companies.
Yeah. And I lost everything. They were all, they all fell flat in the bust. Yeah. And also I was just a bad investor at that time. Like, you know, so, but then that triggered something. Then I became obsessed. The next obsession, I became obsessed with investing. So after being obsessed with entrepreneurship for a few years, I became obsessed with investing. And I probably read 200 or 300 books on investing. I read everything I could. I knew every investing strategy. And then I wrote software. I brought in my computer experience. I wrote software and I took 70 years of data from the stock market and analyze and use wrote AI programs to analyze the data for patterns where in odd situations certain trades would work 100% of the time, like situations you wouldn't expect would be like boom, automatic trade. And like literally I was dead broke and I needed to make, just to support my family, I needed to take all of my money that I had left and make 100% a month in 2002, which was at that time the worst year in market history since like 1933
right.
or 32. And so it was very, so, and I had a philosophy that the internet's going to do well and the stock market's going to do well in the long run. So I would never bet against the market. And even though the market went down 20% that year, my software was making money almost every single day.
Is this Stock Picker?
No, that was later.
That was later. Okay.
So, but I included elements of this later. So using this, then I started a hedge fund. So I got in the hedge fund business. I raised money. I invested other people's money. I was doing really well. Then I knew so many hedge fund strategies. I started what's called a fund of hedge funds. I'm just going right through this. I started a fund of hedge funds, meaning people would give me money and I would invest in a variety of hedge fund strategies because I knew at this point, because of the obsession aspect of doing 12 hours a day of something for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, I knew everything about every investment strategy. I knew all the hedge fund managers. I knew who were the criminals, who weren't. And so I would invest in the best hedge funds. And then also, because I had all this knowledge, I started a writing career. So I started writing for the Financial Times, a column, the Wall Street Journal, the Street.com, Yahoo Finance. I started going on CNBC. So I had two careers. I was making money as a hedge fund manager. I was making money as a writer. I started writing books, like best-selling books in the finance space, totally in the finance space. Mm-hmm. And then I became a spokesperson for Fidelity. So I started giving talks around the country, making money that way. So I started building a career mm-hmm. as a well-known finance professional. And then I started another internet business, combining my interest in finance with my internet skills. So that was Stock Picker.
And you wrote about how you gained a lot of that money and then lost it all.
Yeah. So once again, I made all that money and then I sold it. Right. And then I lost it.
Right. And writing about that really kind of worked. Something about that clicked. People liked that.
Yeah. So then what happened was this, you know, so
which I've kind been, of also has to do with stand-up comedy because yeah. It's like that self-deprecation.
Yeah. So what interesting. So again, I've just been sticking with the obsessions. I've left out some other stuff where I made and lost, but then what happened was I'd made and lost so many times that I'm like, and the market was crashing and I was an optimist. So all the newspapers got rid of me. All the TV stations didn't want to have me. They brought me back on later when the market started going back up, but everybody goes with the trend, not the trend. Everybody goes with what's happening right that moment. And I was an optimist and everybody else was a pessimist. So nobody wanted to talk to me. But I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to write the pure honesty. So, which people in the finance business never do. Like people were writing to me and like, how could you admit this? Like no one's going to work this way with you again, which was totally wrong. But when I started just writing my story instead of writing about investments or finance, when I started writing my story, my literary skills that I had worked on 20 years earlier started to really come out. Like I viewed myself as more of a story, as writing stories than as writing about any one point. I was writing like what I felt were literary stories, but they happened to be true about me.
Right.
And I would write about my failures. I'd write about being suicidal. I wrote about being suicidal yesterday. So I'd write this. And
do you think that you are?
No. I mean, I would write about when I was.
When you were. Okay.
I realized, the audience, the demand for this kind of article and story and style, because I also was writing very humorously. I would combine suicide with very humorous writing, or, you know, I'd write about the time I screwed Yasser Arafat out of $2 million, true story. And I wrote it in a very humorous fashion that was very self-deprecating. Like, not only self-deprecating, I almost made it seem like I was committing a crime, which I wasn't, but it was like I put myself to the edge. But I write a lot of articles like that, and some people hated them. And I've experienced for the first time this phenomenon of having lots of people who liked what I was saying, and then the occasional, like people were saying I was like the Charles Bukowski of finance or entrepreneurship. Right. But then I also got this haters for the first time, like people actually hated me.
Sign of success. Hmm? So that's a sign of success.
I could tell myself that, but I still didn't like it. Like it's really hard when people are writing entire articles about how much they hated me.
That comes with success. That's how you know you're succeeding, when you see haters come.
Well, it happens to me now.
No one is
on
successful.
A daily basis, like or at least a tweet or
yeah,
you know, once a year.
You've made it.
Well, once a year there will be. It used to be once a year. Now it's a little more than that. There would be an article hating me that all the haters would suddenly come out and say, "Yeah, good for you writing about this, you know, freak." And so well, once a year that was happening since about 2011, and then last year was a little bit more. And then this year it's like once a day there's at least something on some social media where some guy says something, and then it's really hard to like not respond because you can't respond to some stranger on the internet, like
right.
You know, that's like the worst way to live your life.
Yeah,
you know your life's over if you start doing that. Like
you're giving them power that they really don't deserve.
Like, and also just strategically, why should I lend my audience to them? Just, they have no followers, and I'm the only one who sees them trashing me.
Right.
Why do I respond to that and lend them my entire audience?
Just block.
Yeah.
Do you block?
I do block. Yeah. Good. I always block. And then there was a guy the other day who I would block. He would start up other accounts, and then I just muted. So I can't see what he says. He could see my stuff, but he doesn't know that I've muted him.
Right.
So, but this happens every day. And
if you could twist it in your mind and say, well, that's a sign of success.
I try, I also try all the other cliches, and cliches are there because they're mostly true, but I try like, oh, they're jealous or this or that. Cause sometimes it's people I know and I write to them like, well, hey, we're friends. We've been friends for 10 years. How could you all of a sudden like say I'm the worst kind of human being possible?
Right. And that's hard with friends. You think they're your friend, and then sometimes you get some success and instead of being happy for you, they're just like jealous or envious.
And I would say, I mean, again, like that happened to me Sunday.
Yeah.
And what day is today? Wednesday.
Yeah.
So that happens to me like once a week. Again, sometimes more extreme than others. Sometimes people will be very public about it. And sometimes people will be, I'm like, huh, I just noticed this person is not my friend anymore.
They're not, a friend wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's happened to me. It's happened to me with family members. Family is sometimes the hardest because if somebody wanted to be a writer and they've been working at it and suddenly you write a book that's a major bestseller, they stop talking to you for some weird reason that has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah.
You have to say, well, I guess they were jealous or something because this was a close family member forever.
My old band, when we got our European booking agent, and I told a friend, I was excited, we're going to get to tour Europe all over the place. Because, I want to tour Europe.
Yeah, right. And also in when you have relationships, you have to be very careful with, you know, someone's good for you if they're not jealous of your success. Like, you cannot compete with your spouse or your romantic partner. Chris Rock actually mentioned that on his last special, Tambourine. Yeah. But it's a truism that I've noticed through all my relationships. Like, something is just bad news if your romantic partner is competing with your career. So,
and you can't have a friend that's going to be jealous. A good friend will be like genuinely happy for you.
Well, what's painful is when someone really is a good friend and you've been in the trenches together for years as a good friend, and then suddenly, boom, they're actively working against you.
Yeah.
They're not even ignoring you. They're actively working against you. And it's just painful. Success, people think, oh, when I have some success, because nobody's a success. Everyone's looking for some success and they want it to keep increasing. No matter, you could be 90 years old and you want your success to keep increasing. You still don't view yourself as a success. But success is not about being happy. Like, it's another kind of emotion, and there's a lot of unhappiness associated with it.
How do you define success? I define success as freedom of time.
Yeah, so I'll say freedom of time as well, but in a different way. I very much, you know, so I wrote a book called Choose Yourself, which is very much my philosophy of life in a lot of ways. But I define freedom as every day, because nothing is fixed. A river is always flowing. So every day, you have to be making more, or every week or every month, you know, some moving average of this, more choice. You have to be making more choices that are your choice than someone else's choice. So, and then that doesn't mean you work for yourself or work by yourself. Could be you're doing something you love with a group of people, but you just don't want to be working at a job you don't like where your boss, who you also don't like, is making all of your choices for you and none of them you like.
Right. That's the opposite of freedom.
Right. That's why a corporate job is often more risky than entrepreneurship. So, because your boss could fire you without in a moment's notice, and most of the time you're doing things you don't like, so you don't have that sort of well-being that comes with freedom, and you're probably doing things you don't like. Mm-hmm. So it's and your retirement might not be as predictable when you have a corporate job as opposed to entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So if you're persistent with entrepreneurship, eventually, and by the way, you could be an entrepreneur and be an employee. I have another book, which is actually one of my, I think one of my best books, but it's nobody ever reads it. It was like one of my worst selling books, but it's called The Rich Employee. It's how you could choose yourself while being an employee and be successful and wealthy and have freedom and so on. And for some reason, that book I thought would be a success because most people, there's 100 million employees in the US. But people are like, no, I want to hear about entrepreneurship. I don't want to hear about being an employee.
Right.
So
they want the aspirational, not the, yeah, that's me.
Right. Right. But I tell them you could be an employee and love what you do and be successful. But, and also success too is freedom, but also doing what you love. So, you know, last night I did stand-up comedy, for instance. I was the MC, so that's 2 hours, which meant probably 3 or 4 hours before then I'm preparing for it, so that's 5 hours, and then an hour afterwards I'm like so wired I'm unwinding from it. Mm-hmm. So that's 6 hours that I could have spent either writing or spending time with family or reading books or doing or looking at investments or whatever. But I love doing stand-up comedy, which makes zero money.
Yeah.
And really, I can argue there's some benefits in other areas of my life, but not really.
It does benefit other areas.
It does benefit other areas. I won't argue with that.
Yeah.
But I won't say that's the reason I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I just happen to, for obscure reasons. I wish I didn't love doing it, actually, but I love doing it.
Yes.
So that's like the latest obsession.
Right.
But
This is the personal reinvention that you've been having throughout your life.
I mean,
you're so many different people.
Yeah, so after I lost this money on Stock Picker, I got and I lost that money not by investing, but I got paid for that company in stock, and the market crashed. So that stock went down. I bought a big house, so I lost that money. I didn't make as much money as I would have liked on the sale of that business.
And throughout this year, you're also a father and a husband. You're raising kids.
Yeah, yeah. So I was really anxious and depressed and scared because I was going broke again.
How old were your children at this time? That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I mean, ages like, they were on average, let's say around 10, okay. 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
And
how many, two?
I have two kids, yeah. Okay. Well, now I have 5 kids, but yes.
Now you have 5?
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
Through marriage and okay. 4 daughters and a son. And so then I got obsessed with writing again, and I was writing all day long. I was reading and writing all day long. I moved upstate and living upstate, and I had no distractions, and it was heaven. I was just, I became an angel investor, meaning I was investing in private companies, but by this point I was a good investor. Again, I put my 10,000 hours into studying investing. I had been a good hedge fund manager. I was a good investor. So, and I removed the risk. I only invest in private companies, you know, and I remove risk in so many different ways. But my returns are probably close to 200% per year since 2007.
Still?
Yeah.
Ooh, wow.
This year is my best year ever as an investor.
Are you still giving tips?
Yeah. I have a whole business giving tips. So I'm an entrepreneur too. I have a whole business that is newsletters giving stock tips, but I don't do angel investing tips because angel investing is what I do, personally, but because I do it personally, I don't want to have a conflict of interest.
Right.
But I use the same ideas of removing risk in, I could be a stock market investor, and I do a little bit because some of my companies that I invested in privately have gone public and now they're on the stock market, but the same principles can be applied to any kind of investing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've done very well at that. But the thing about angel investing is, you know, particularly when I was just starting it, is you don't make money every day. Sometimes I'm in some investments for over 11 years.
Yeah, it's the long game.
Yeah, I'm meeting in one of my investments tonight at the comedy club, actually. And I've been in that one for 11 years. And I don't even want him. I don't want to cash. The only way you cash out of a private company is if they sell the business. Mm-hmm. So I don't even want him to sell, because the stock market goes up, let's whatever, 7% a year. He's doubling his business every year. So why do I want him? I wouldn't want him to stop doubling. Where else am I going to put the money? Am I going to put it in the stock market or put it in a savings account with 1.5% interest? He's making he's improving the value of his company 100% a year. So I encourage him to keep going, but he's now thinking of selling, which he should. He's getting older. Uh-huh. Nobody wants to run a company forever.
Yeah.
It's horrible. But anyway, so I became obsessed with writing again, and I've written on my website, there's over 3,000 articles that I've written since that time. And then I got obsessed with podcasting. We've done so many great, an amazing bucket list moment podcast.
You've had all kinds of people on your podcast. Richard Branson. I can't even count how many amazing people you've had.
Yeah. I mean, from, you know, Tony Hawk, who was the world champion skateboarder. Sarah Blakely is the most successful self-made female billionaire. But it's not about business. It's about peak performance. So that's had on Garry Kasparov, was the best chess player in history. Had on Coolio, who I think was one of the best rappers in history. Had on Tyra Banks, who's one of the best, not only was one of the best models, but really became one of the best, most successful TV producers and personalities in history. She had 29 seasons of America's Next Top Model when everyone rejected the idea at first. So all these amazing stories. I had William Shatner, Henry Winkler, many comedians, like most of our favorite comedians have been on the podcast.
Gary Goldman was
Sonia Sotomayor is the first time a Supreme Court justice ever went on a podcast. Eric Schmidt, chairman of Google, is about to come on the podcast. Just came back from a podcast with Dave Barry, one of my favorite humorous writers and one of my favorite writers in general. Mm-hmm. A lot of my favorite writers have come on the podcast. 500 guests, so many great and interesting people. I've learned so much because my whole idea is I'm not a journalist. I'm not trying to interview them like a journalist. My insidious reason for having someone on my podcast, I want to learn from them. And then hopefully the listeners learn too. But I just want to learn, like, how did you do this? Like, when you were getting over your crack addiction, like, how did you do that? Or Sebastian Maniscalco, when you were just starting to make money at comedy, how did you build it up? And, you know, what's your technique? And how did you practice that? And so on.
Is there a similar thread that you see doing the podcast that you're hearing from successful people?
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, and actually I wrote a book about that that's coming out soon where I focus on the billionaires because that's what people are most interested in. It's called Think Like a Billionaire, but the same principles apply to everyone I've interviewed, which is that there's a persistence. There's, you know, nobody's successful when they're first starting because by definition, they suck when they first start. You need experience to be better at something. So you have to have some kind of weird confidence that makes you think you can be better when there's no evidence whatsoever that you can be.
Right.
And so there's a certain persistence, a certain what Nassim Taleb would call anti-fragility. Like what
How about
are you?
A bit of delusion?
Yeah, there's certainly got to be delusion. Richard Branson was like 26 years old when he's like, and there was only one airline in England, British Airways, and it was run by the government. So how can you compete? It's like, it's insane. And he was a 26-year-old magazine publisher, but he calls up Boeing and he says, can I borrow a plane? Can I borrow a 747 jet? Then he calls up Heathrow and he says, I got this 747 jet. Can I land it there? And then suddenly he had... and he called up JFK. Suddenly he had a route between Heathrow and JFK.
Yeah.
And he had an airline. What he was a music magazine publisher, you know, from the 70s. Like, so who knows what else he was into.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, I'm going to start an airline. That's delusional.
Yeah.
Sarah Blakely, she didn't know anything about fashion. She started maybe the most successful fashion line in history now, Spanx.
People probably not surrounded by naysayers. You know, those people like, ah, you can't do that. Everything's been done before.
Well, that's why in my book, Choose Yourself, written in 2013, one of the most... People always say, oh, I've lost everything. I'm divorced. I'm on the ground. I'm depressed. How can I get up off the ground? Can you give me a stock tip or a business strategy? No. The first thing is, you know, be healthy, because if you're sick, you're not going to be able to generate ideas.
Yep.
And then very important, people kind of skip this in the book, be emotionally healthy. Get rid of all the toxic people in your life. Even if it's a spouse, even if it's a family member, even if it's your best friend, if they're a naysayer, or if they're competing with your career, or if they're bringing you down in some way, or if you have to go to too many parties with them because or else you're jealous or whatever, they're not good for you. You need everybody around you has to be part of the team. And just like you'll support them and their efforts and make their dreams come true, they will help you make your dreams come true. Like, and you look at all the success. 100% of the successful people in the world, 100% of the people on our podcast, none of them have toxic people in their life that they have to deal with.
If your kid's a little naysayer, put them in foster care.
Well, kids are always naysayers, and you have to put up with kids. But there's ways of dealing with that in parenting, too. Like, if they're going to be crying all the time, go to your room. That's what a good parent says. You don't try to pander to your kids just so they can be happy. Like, you know, you don't harm them in any way, but
you did write a blog post, advice for your daughter. Advice I want to tell my daughters.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm expecting.
By the way, that one might have been the very first post in this style that I did. I think I did that in either 2000. No, I did that in mid 2010. It was the first post of that style.
Meaning on a more personal level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really love that post. It was the very first one I did like that, and. But I also wrote a post. I've done a couple of posts like shitting on my kids. I did when my oldest became a teenager.
Yeah. How old are they now?
Now they're, well, the two original ones are 20 and 17.
Okay.
But when my 20-year-old was turning 13 and 14, she started to be like a teenager. So I wrote a post that was her writing a letter to me and in her tone. And, it really made fun of her a lot, but she didn't care because she didn't care about anything I did. So,
was she offended by it?
No, they have never. Well, one time I wrote something about one of my kids where she said, "Daddy," she called me up. Actually, her sister called me up and she said, "Daddy, Molly really wants you to take that down." And I took it down, and then Molly got on the phone and said, "Daddy, I can't trust you anymore." And so, you know, I didn't think it would bother her, but it did. But I took it down, and no one saw it.
I'm asking this selfishly because I'm expecting a kid at the end of August.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you, my first. Are there any?
Your life is just gonna suck. There is nothing good about having a baby.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Like, tell me something good. Tell me something good that other people have told you. Like, oh, your life's going to be so wonderful. You'll never love a creature more than you'll love this little bag of shit.
First of all, thank you for the honesty, because all you ever hear is, oh, it's going to be so great. So thank you for saying that.
From the first second, right? They give you, like, even before the first second, right? First off, your wife is constantly a drag right now. Like, she's in pain. She's got morning sickness. She can't do lots of things she used to be able to do. You love your wife. I'm not saying treat her. She's not toxic. I'm not saying she's toxic.
Foster care to her.
I'm just saying, if you say something, her response is, if she doesn't like it, she's going to say, I'm pregnant.
Right.
And then you're like, okay, forget I said that. Rewind. Like, sorry. And then she's in labor. You have to be there, right? But she's the center of attention by far. Yeah. You're like sitting in the bleachers, and she's Derek Jeter. So, like, am I making a sports reference? Okay. and then the baby's born. Like, so you really feel like, what
I mean, it's already like that. Now when I speak to a family member, it's like, oh, how's Abby?
Right. Wait, but like when you're, when she's in labor though, it's like doctors and nurses swarming around.
Right.
Excuse me. Like you have to stand there for hours. Like you're just, it's like going to like your later on when you go to your daughter's ballet performance, it's like almost as bad as that. Like you're just standing there doing nothing. Nobody likes to stand around doing nothing. You want to be useful.
But what about all the love it brings into
your
life?
Okay. So then the baby is born and that's when everybody says, oh, you've never seen a more beautiful creature in your life. And blah, blah, blah. You'll feel more love than you've ever felt before. This is like your son or daughter. But what happens is your wife is still having medical issues, right? Mm-hmm. There's still medical things happening. So they say, hey, can you hold this? And they give you a baby.
It's to crazy.
Hold. And you don't know. I didn't know how to hold a baby. It wasn't like maybe for seconds here and there I held a baby. But like I'm holding this baby that's crying and squirming around.
And all your responsibility.
And is all bloody. So both times I thought they say, here, hold this. So you stick out your arms, right? So now you're holding something that's fairly heavy, right? Like it's 7 or 8 pounds. And it might be an hour you're in this position with your hands sticking straight out, holding this baby. Like you should start weightlifting now. Like, and your arms start to really hurt, but I didn't want to do anything. Like I felt like the baby's so small, I'm going to break her arm, or I really thought I like was going to damage my baby or drop her or whatever. I didn't know what to do. And always I thought I was damaging her in some way, like breaking an arm or breaking a leg. And then your life is just over, like this crying all the time. Your wife was a great roommate, right? Like that's why you got married.
Yeah.
Oh my God, she's the best roommate ever. And it's a roommate I'm having sex with.
Yeah.
Like, and we could have sex in the morning, have sex at night, have sex during the day. We could binge watch Game of Thrones if we want. And we could, I don't know. Oh, let's get up and drive to Montreal today. You could just, it's such an amazing roommate. Then suddenly you have another roommate and this roommate doesn't speak English, cries all the time, shits all the time, cries all night. And then have you ever had a roommate that all of a sudden now she climbs in your wife's bed and sucks on your wife's breast? Like, this is a horrible roommate.
This is sounding like a bit.
It's slightly a bit. And I didn't. And so, yes, of course. Oh, this is my daughter. I love her. And I really did feel love. And I remember when my second child was born,
You did it again.
I was really sad. Like I thought, how can I love a second child? When my wife was in pregnant, I really thought, how can I love a second child as much as I love my first? Cause I really loved her. But of course you love your second child just as much. And there's never a competition. Like it's always, you love these two very equally, but they suck. Like you go to ballet. I have never, who wants to go? What adult, what male adult wakes up and says, you know what? I really want to drive 70 miles a day to watch a bunch of 13-year-olds perform ballet.
There's no like sense of pride or amazement that you created this thing.
And the 3 seconds during the 3-hour show, the 3 seconds they are doing ballet, I feel that. But that's 3 seconds out of 3 hours. And the other 2 hours.
Well, that's like stand-up comedy. You have a great set. It's an 8-minute set and it gets you through the whole night.
Yeah, but it doesn't. No. Like the comedy does get you through a whole night, like a great 8-minute set. Ballet, I just watched my kid on ballet. Can I go now? No, because there's the final performance where that's how they keep the parents. All the kids participate in the final performance. You can't leave.
Right.
So I got to watch all this. Oh, I hate ballet. I hate ballet music. It's not like you're watching professional ballerinas. They're the worst ballerinas on the planet. And it's just horrible.
So wait, are you saying that if you could do it again, you would not?
No, of course. I love my kids. Now I have 5 kids. I'm so happy like to have such a great family life and
right.
everything. But now my kids are kind of bordering on being adults.
So what do I do? I'm getting mixed messages here. What do I do?
Nothing, man. It's not a horrible thing to not ever have kids. Like then you don't know one way or the other.
Right.
And you still have that kind of freedom of not having kids. But kids teach you so much and, mm-hmm. you know, you're not supposed to be happy all the time. Like,
you only regret the things you don't do.
There you go. And, you know, I regret sometimes that in the 15 years that I was so, or 10 years, I was so depressed and anxious about money and losing and frightened and scared. I regret I didn't spend more time with them. Because the ages of like 6 to 8 are really great ages,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the ages of like 11 and 12 are really great ages. Like I have such great memories of my kids, like 11 and 12 and 68. Mm-hmm. And of course, even now, I just went with one of my kids to, she wanted to go on a business trip with me, which was great. And we went to London and Paris, and it's like, oh, so fun to like spend mm-hmm. this time with my kid. And so there's some things that are just great.
You have any brothers or sisters?
I have two sisters.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
I was getting an only child kind of vibe from you.
Well, one's 7 years younger, the other's 9 years older.
Okay.
So I essentially was raised as an only son, mm-hmm. you know, because the other two were so far apart. Yeah. One's a half sister, so I didn't grow up with her. The other, but we were very close. And then the other was so much younger than me, we didn't really, mm-hmm. you know, interact as much. And
was having kids a big strain on your marriage before that? It was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I really did not want to have kids.
Oh, you didn't want them?
No, I did not. But my wife did. And I'm glad I did. I am so glad I did.
Right.
Despite everything I just said. But I did not want them.
We'll edit that out.
No, that's fine. It's that's the truth. It really is not pleasant. There is nothing pleasant about the first year or two other than this amorphous, like, oh, that's my kid. I love her. There's nothing that actually happens that makes you think, oh, my life is so much better now because I have a kid.
Right.
Like, I didn't really start enjoying them in that kind of practical way until they could play games with me and until they were good at the games. So, like, I would have to make up games that they could be good at that then I'm like, oh, this is fun.
Right.
So, like, chess, they can never be as good as me at chess, no problem. So I would make up a game where we would just set up the pawns, no other pieces, and whoever gets a pawn to the other side of the board first wins. So that they could play, and it was fun.
Yeah.
Or checkers. Or I would make up card games that were like mini pokers that could be fun.
Besides the obvious, what was the stress that it put on your marriage?
I did not want to take care of like a baby. Mm-hmm. I did not want to do it.
Like, so she felt like you weren't carrying the weight?
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, I was busy losing all my money at that point. So I had like work to do. And then I was busy being anxious and scared and depressed all the time and thinking, how can I make this money back?
Was a lot of that you felt pressure because you were a father that you had?
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. I probably would have, but probably the marriage wouldn't have survived either way.
Well, what if you were just single and you're like, whatever, I don't need really anything.
Yeah, then my life would have been a lot different.
It would have been, yeah. So maybe it did serve it in a way because it kind of kicked you in the ass to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what's the slogan? With necessity. Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
So Steve Cohen, podcast producer and quote machine.
Nice. I know you have another podcast to conduct.
I have something on the schedule, right?
You have a guest coming.
I'm on someone else's podcast.
Oh, okay. So I don't want to make you too late. So we'll wrap it up soon. But you have a comedy tour coming up in June.
Yeah.
So we barely covered like so much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because then I became obsessed with stand-up comedy.
Right.
So I became an entrepreneur again. And now everything I do is better than the old version of it. So I'm a better entrepreneur than I used to be.
You started another company that you sold again.
Yeah.
Stock Picker.
That was in 2000. I started another company in 2015, which I also have sold. But now I know how to do it. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that I know now. I know how to start a company. I know how to build the right relationships I need. I know how to create more value for the company so it can get sold for a higher amount. I know how to have ongoing deals with whoever I sell to so I continue to do as well as if I'm still part of, you know, an owner of the company.
Mm-hmm.
I know, and my investing skills are a million times better than they used to be. So mm-hmm. So everything that I used to do, I do better now because, again, necessity is the mother of invention. I had to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a lot of tips written on your blog for entrepreneurship. And I was reading through them for starting your own company.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading through them. I was like, I'm kind of doing this with my company.
Yeah.
Like, cool. Like, don't hire people unless you absolutely really need to. Don't take investment money.
Yeah.
Which I'm so glad I didn't do. I was like, no, this is fine. I could do this.
Right. Because now you have an income stream that's all yours. And if you had even one investor, and even if they were a minority investor, there's going to be pressure.
You have to answer to them.
And they become your boss a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not fully, but a little bit. And again, the goal is you can't always do this. Like Uber, if you want to start Uber, you have to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to start like a major company, you have to raise money. Sometimes in order to expand, you have to raise money to hire or whatever, or to build offices. But I think most of the time now, you don't really need there's more venture capital money available than ever before, but there's less reason to raise money than ever before. Right.
We'll get back to the comedy, and this is like such a divergence, but what do you think of companies like Uber, where they just spend so much money and they just lose so much money every year?
So I think what's happening with many of these companies, I don't need to call out any specifically, but with many of these companies, they're living on what I call VC welfare.
Yeah.
So let's call out Uber for a second. When you take a ride on an Uber, a venture capitalist is paying for part of your ride, is subsidizing that ride, just like the government might subsidize, you know, a farm.
Right.
But what happens when all that subsidizing runs out? We don't really know yet. Mm-hmm. Now with Amazon, they were being subsidized for a very long time, 20 years almost, and then finally they started making a huge profit.
Right.
But it took them a lot of different business models. Amazon is not one company. It's like maybe 1,000 different business
models. And their main money is their servers. Right?
Yeah, like AWS, Amazon Web Services, makes an enormous amount of money, which by the way was very smart. And I talk about that in my tips for entrepreneurship. If you have a way of making money, you can now meta that, which is what Amazon did, meaning, you know, allow other people to piggyback on your infrastructure for how you originally made money.
Right.
So Amazon originally made money by creating a huge infrastructure for selling millions and millions of books and logistics and so on. Now they sell that as a service, the ability to have all this storage, the ability to sell things, the ability to use their logistics.
Right.
So that's genius. Like if you, that's how you really scale to make a big business.
I'm like, my mind's like, how do I do it with mine? How do I do it with mine?
Cool. There's always a way to do it, one way or the other. There's like five different ways to do it, which Amazon tries, by the way. So Amazon did Meta in a different way. They built a website that has a large amount of traffic. So what do you do with that traffic? Well, let's make TV shows and
right.
have the traffic is watching the TV shows so we can sell subscriptions to that or whatever, however they monetize it. And of course, very initially, they were selling books. Oh, let's sell clothes. So that was the initial way they meta, they took their business strategy and they meta strategy.
Right.
I have to come up with a better word for that.
It's kind of like a reskinning kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, white labeling it.
Kind of, yeah, something. But they did it in a lot of different ways, and that's how they ultimately became profitable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if their bookstore makes money.
Mm-hmm. They've obviously diversified quite a bit.
Yeah.
Whole Foods now.
But, you know, they do foods, but I think the real reason they bought Whole Foods, and we talked about this in one of the podcasts with a really smart guy, Scott Galloway, is Whole Foods, you know, imagine... You know, Amazon, they deliver in one day because they have warehouses all over the country storing, you know, thousands and thousands of products. Think about Whole Foods. It's another 5,000 warehouses potentially. If they just empty out all those Whole Foods or even empty out half of them, they have more space now to have a lot more products to get you products faster. So I think that was part of their strategy in buying Whole Foods.
Right.
Again, taking Meta, the whole concept of Whole Foods.
Right.
So it's not just a place to buy food. It's a place to store any object that needs to be quickly delivered.
Right. So with companies like Uber, just to use as an example, they're really kind of banking on the driverless car, it seems.
Yeah, right, because that's how they're setting up the whole infrastructure now.
Right.
The app, the brand awareness, the handling the transactions, handling problems, the search between customer and driver. But then once it's driverless, boom, they save like 50% of their costs and then they might be profitable.
And then that's where the profits come.
Maybe. We'll see.
Right.
We don't really know yet.
Yeah. So would you invest in a company that's taking so much venture capitalist welfare?
Not in the beginning, no.
Mm-hmm.
Because then there's too much risk. And then I also won't have control. So in the beginning, you have a little more control. If you're part of a company values itself at $4 million, they're raising $1 million, so 4 plus 1, they'll be worth $5 million at the end of their raise. So now they have $1 million in cash and $4 million of equity, so they're worth $5 million in total. If I'm one of a few investors, I can call the other investors. I know them personally probably, and then you have a little more control. I probably know the CEO personally at that point, a little more sway in what's happening. If I'm just piggybacking on a $50 million raise, it's a different type of strategy. I don't say it's bad or worse. It's a different type of strategy.
Right.
It's not mine.
So would you invest in Uber right now?
Definitely not.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But there are some people, like take Peter Thiel as an example. Great investor, brilliant guy, one of the top 10 smartest guys who's been on my podcast. His strategy is to invest in companies only when they have $1 billion plus valuation, because his argument is if their valuation is that high already, first off, that means there's a lot of professional investors who've done a lot of hard work valuing this company and understanding it and understanding the industry and understanding the trends and understanding the competitors. Second, there's a lot of incentive for all of these very smart and very well-connected investors to keep that valuation above $1 billion or get the company sold. Mm-hmm. And that works. That strategy works. So if a company's worth $1 billion and it looks like things are trouble, call up our buddies at Google or Facebook or whatever, buy this for $3 billion. Okay. You know, Google's worth $1 trillion. $3 billion is 0.3%.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a different strategy and that works too. That's a way to mitigate the risk too.
Mm-hmm.
My best way of mitigating risk is to be in a $4 million round where someone like Peter Thiel is my co-investor. So then I like got the best of every world.
Yeah.
Low valuation, the best investor. I don't have to think.
So knowing who else is invested in the company is important.
I won't invest without knowing who else is invested. Mm-hmm. If I'm the main investor that they're counting on, that is a shitty company. So I won't invest.
Right. Okay.
But that's how I would lose all my money before. I would get greedy. Like, I'm going to take over a third of this company. I'm going to invest a huge amount of money. So I take over. And then 6 months later, we just ran out of money. Can you write more checks?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, there's no one to turn to.
The CEO of Uber, he's probably taking a pretty generous salary.
No, I think he's not even the CEO. Oh, the current CEO is not the founder, mm-hmm. right? The founder left.
Did the founder get bought out?
Well, at the $120 billion level, SoftBank came in and bought out anybody who wanted to get bought out. But we don't know who got bought out or not.
Okay.
Some of my friends got bought out. If you put in $25,000 into the seed round and you got bought out, you got bought out for $125 million.
Yikes. And it's still not profitable.
No. It's not going to be profitable for a long time.
Yeah. And many things could change.
Yeah.
With technology and everything. Okay. We got to wrap this up. So your comedy tour coming up in June?
June. Yeah. Doing, and I'm not trying to promote it here, but doing California, Boston, Cleveland, but then that's really just a test run for the fall.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing your podcast and a stand-up set.
Yeah. I'm doing a stand-up set and then podcast.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool. And these will be listed on your website, I imagine.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We
have to. I was just reminding you, so we have to start promoting it.
Mm-hmm. We started. We did it.
Yeah.
Cool. I mean, I could just go on and on, but
We could do another one sometime about comedy, because we could probably just talk for hours about stand-up comedy, but because that is like my obsession right now. I put a lot of time into thinking about that, because again, learning how to learn. I feel that one skill I got out of anything is, just like I mentioned with games, learning how to learn, mm-hmm. how to take the 10,000 hours I learned from some other area and translate it into this has helped me a lot.
Yeah.
And so sometimes people say to me, you can't skip the line. You know, you gotta, you know, it's just like people saying about politics. Oh, you gotta first be a congressman, then a senator, then a vice president, then a governor, then a vice president, then a president. No, if you're good at understanding how to skip the line, like Barack Obama was, that skill set of skipping the line applies to many areas. So you know, you've probably heard it in comedy. People hear it in writing, people hear it in TV, people hear it in entrepreneurship. You can't skip the line. But you can if you know how to do it.
Mm. Like, for example, a lot of people, when they start comedy, they'll start a bar show to just get more stage time. You skipped the line by buying Stand Up New York.
Well, that's true. That helped me. But I've also done bar shows. I've done that.
Of course. Yeah.
Here's another thing
But you want to guarantee yourself stage time, because that's the only way to get better.
Right. So owning a bar doesn't guarantee me stage time, by the way, because I always tell the booker, if I'm no good, do not book me. And there has been times where I have not been booked, where I was changing material and it was rough.
Uh-huh.
So there have been times where I was sweating it out. Am I just like any other comedian? Am I going to get booked at my own club? People would say to me, it's your own club. Just force them. And I'm like, no, I will never, ever do that.
Uh-huh.
And so I'll go up at other clubs, sometimes more than my own club.
Right.
Because then also it proves to other comedians that I'm not just getting stage time because it's my club. But I've done bar shows where I've rented out a bar and, you know, opened it up. And I've even because I've done a lot of public speaking and writing, I'm good at storytelling and humorous storytelling, but I wanted to get good at one-liners. So I even have gone on a subway car and done stand-up to a very, unhappy audience.
Yes.
To have tight one-liners. And see if I can get them to laugh, boom, I've got it. And then I would switch cars every stop. Mm-hmm. So
how'd that go?
Well, I can't say I really did well, but it was a good way to learn.
Yeah.
So I did get some one-liners and learn something about doing one-liners, which is a different skill than doing stand-up, really. But there's other things. I've had on 20 comedians on the podcast, and I'm not just saying, hey, you know, how you doing today? I'm thinking about what happened to me the night before, and I say to them, suppose this happened to you when you're on stage, what would you do? And I get like right. lessons. How often do I get like, let's say, some of the best comedians in the world, like let's say Sebastian Maniscalco, giving me one-on-one coaching mm-hmm. on comedy? I'm just asking him about my own comedy experiences, and he's telling me everything he would do.
Yeah,
so it's amazing. Or like with Bert Kreischer, oh, say you have a joke like this, you know, and you're getting laughs, like, and you feel like there's something more, what would you do? And on the fly, he would come up with like more tags and this and that, mm-hmm. and that's like a great joke yep. for me now.
Those are my favorite episodes of your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
You got good tips, like Gary Goldman was great.
Yeah, he's been on 3 times. He's mm-hmm. been amazing.
Yeah, he sounded way better this last time.
Yeah.
That was good.
He's in good shape.
Yeah. Whew. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Gary, thank you so much for having me on. I hope we can do this again. It was a great conversation. And Crystal Lake on Sundays.
You'll every Sunday night, Crystal Lake, Brooklyn, 7:30 p.m.
I wonder if I'm doing anything. You're probably booked this Sunday night. Can I do the Sunday after? I'm not trying to hold you to anything. I'm just...
I'll check out the booking thing, but absolutely. Definitely.
All right. Yeah. Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.